The good, the bad, and the alternative. By Madame Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based on the works of Andrew Hussey. Chapter 4. I'll Wait for You. Terezi and Karkat sat on their bridge, legs dangling over the water as they relaxed in companionable silence, enjoying the warm drizzle of the dwindling rainfall. They had spent part of the day helping Nepeta move furniture upstairs, clearing the first floor of their home to give Equius more space. Upon his arrival, they had stayed a few hours longer, Karkat helping Equius set up his paperwork while Terezi and Nepeta got down to some quality role-playing time, busting into Nepeta's new color pencils to redesign their OCs. Terezi had enjoyed the visit, but was glad they had left. Nepeta had been brimming with excitement as soon as Equius arrived, and Terezi had the feeling that Nepeta wanted her partner all to herself for a little while. Terezi glanced over at the dark smear, all that her eyes could discern of Karkat sitting beside her. She blinked slowly, imagining her aura sight slipping into place like the clear second lid of a crocodile. She looked at her friend again, this time discerning not just the blur of limbs and the suggestion of a head, but instead something much easier to comprehend. She inhaled deeply, letting the sweetness of his aura envelop her. She secretly imagined him biting into a delectable strawberry covered in marshmallow goo. The chances of him partaking in such a dessert were slim to none, but he managed to produce an aura that smelled like a sugary treat no matter how many eels and rocks he ate. Blanketing the sugar-spun sweetness was his mood, the soft blue-gray scent of heather, contentment as he sat next to her. She knew that contentment stemmed from the same place as her own inner peace. The joy and satisfaction of another of their friends finally joining them in the city, bringing nearly everyone together. After years of limiting her social life to the alternate, Terezi was happy to have found a home with Karkat in Houston, where so many of her friends already lived, and where the others were able to relocate. Terezi missed the alternate, with its accessibility features that pre-catastrophe cell phones simply could not match. She knew that thousands of messages had been lost, but was hopeful that Solux could recover them one day. All she had to do was be patient. Dragons were supposedly good at patience. She probably could be too.
Yeah. You know what it is. Black and yellow, black and yellow, black and yellow, black and yellow.
The custom ringtone from Karkat's phone signaled that Solux was sending yet another fragment of garbled audio, something that would have been insanity-inducing if they were all still separated. Instead, she fondly regarded the clips as treasured memories of friendship. Terezi wondered if it was a conversation between the two of them from those long hours she spent in the Oklahoma desert, avoiding the restrictive attempts at coddling her foster parents favored for their disabled charges.
Do you want to hear what Solux found this time?
Karkat's phone clicked as he unlocked it and began scrolling, though his motions became hesitant as he focused on the screen. His bass scent sharpened in intensity as he read whatever Solux had sent him. The heathery scent disappeared entirely, and an overwhelming wave of soapy cilantro filled Terezi's senses, choking her with the pale green suds of guilt. She tried to ask what was wrong, but found herself unable to speak for a moment, nearly drowning in the wash of his emotion. She leaned toward him, a hand hesitatingly reaching for his shoulder, unsure of whether to interrupt him or not. While she was frozen in indecision, Karkat apparently finished reading. He shoved the phone at her, and Terezi scrambled with it, startled by the gesture. She raised it to her ear so she could play the raw audio, not bothering with the impossible-to-read transcription on his tiny screen. As the fragment of conversation played, she winced, realizing the magnitude of this conversation, given its timing.
KK and VK chat about prophecy. 03-12-09.
There's no point to this conversation. Stop bothering me about it. Bullshit, Vriska. You know what I'm saying is right. It's coming. The local hunter douchebag told Miss Grubb. What? In the full view of some mossy, bossy alt kid?
Okay, so maybe me and Kanaya were eavesdropping, but we heard enough. It'll be the perfect chance.
Blah. I don't know what amazing prophecy you think you heard, but the Pharaoh isn't going to let me just leave because the world is ending.
Sneak out, dumbass! Hop a bus to Houston! By the time she notices you're gone, whatever the fuck will happen and she won't be able to waste time looking.
Dun, 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 dun.
You can come bum under my bridge, admire my web of truss and girder. You want to be free? Don't pretend you didn't admit it.
Dot, 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 dot. Are you making a pass at me, Carcat? Trusses and girders are so romantic. I'm positively swooning. Swoon, 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 swoon. Look at that, more nasty blush all over me. Whoops.
I'm trying to be descriptive, you eight-legged dipshit. Why do you have to be such a fucking bitch all the time?
The audio ended in a burst of static. When she finished listening, she swallowed roughly, forcing the imaginary suds down her throat so she could speak.
Maybe she didn't go. She could still be at home or skulking around in whatever's left of Vegas. Maybe she just isn't able to reach us without the alternate.
Teresi said this softly, trying to comfort Carcat, to placate the guilt radiating from him that was churning her stomach. It didn't work.
I'm no sand-eating baby, Teresi. Don't coddle me. I told her she should run away. I told her that the fucking apocalypse would be the perfect opportunity. The truth is that I told a vampire to dodge meteors for over 1,000 miles, and she probably got burned to a crisp trying.
Teresi felt guilt of her own rising up as his aura threaded with the salty decay of seaweed that accompanied tears. His hands moved to his face, presumably wiping his eyes. She took a deep breath and tried again.
It's not your fault what happened to her, Carcan. The Pharaoh, speaking the title, put a foul taste in her mouth, is ancient. I bet she knew more about what was coming than you did, or she had advisors that did or something. If Riska really took your advice, it's because what you said was true. She wanted to be free, and this was the best chance she had.
Teresi reached for Carcat, willing him to take her hand, to let her offer what little comfort she could. She pondered what to say for a moment, then decided to focus on all the ways he had made a difference in the past 3 years. The world was bigger than Vischika Satsuket, and he had done their little slice of the world so much good. She squeezed his hand softly.
Even if she did listen to you, did get hurt during the catastrophe, you'd still help me, remember? Took me in? Let me scratch up your bridge with my claws?
He still reeked of guilt, maybe more so than now. Helping one friend and not another, maybe the wrong direction.
And you helped so many others, too. You rescued humans by the dozen during the floods. You found Kanaya after it was all over. You can't forget how long Mama Grub was sending boxes of cookies afterwards.
That was a little better, and he was still curled in on himself.
And Aradia's skull! I don't think anybody but you could have found that at the bottom of the bayou, not to mention eating Gamzee out of that rubble.
She couldn't help but smile at the memory of Carcat gnawing huge chunks of concrete like a feral squirrel. She heard him let out a noise that sounded halfway between a sob and a laugh. Halfway there. She scooted closer.
You made sure we were safe. Anyone you could reach. You helped all those homeless alt kids get roofs over their heads. I know you used the troll quarters to help them with necessities, the ones who were still struggling.
She waffled a little.
That's why I keep some for gumballs.
She sensed a Buena Mulata spark of annoyance flare up briefly. Spicy like lilac set on fire. Better than cilantro.
That's beside the point, though. You even convinced Aridin to let Feferi run her soup kitchen off their houseboat. What I'm saying is, you would have done anything to help Vriska.
She lowered her voice, maybe more than any of us. She smelled the seaweed a little less now, the olive brine of grief washing over the soapy-scented guilt.
But you can't be everywhere. It's not your fault she was too far away. Okay?
Karkat shifted uneasily at her words, but she heard him taking a breath of his own. It was the kind he liked to take before unleashing a rant, but no words came. Instead, he snatched his hand back and pulled himself up onto the railing, squatting on it like a gargoyle for a moment.
I'm sorry. I need some time to be alone. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
He shifted back and forth a little. The sun was setting, and the muddled orange light she could see made him look like a smeared gouache painting.
Thank you, he whispered,
before launching himself off the bridge and into the deep darkness of the river, disappearing into the murk. Terezi was disappointed, knowing that Karkat didn't like to discuss their likely dead friend, and therefore he would be unlikely to continue the conversation, to deal with the emotions before they spiraled out of control. She sighed, listening to the ripples fade away as her friend sank deeper into the water. Aradia. Aradia was watching Salix as he fumbled with the button on his jeans when a crash rang through the house, startling them both. The couple had moved into the bedroom, where Aradia had laid back and allowed Salix to put his forked tongue and extra fingers to good use, enjoying his demonic appendages thoroughly. Unfortunately for him, the sound of someone smashing into one of her curio cabinets, especially one that made the telltale sound of metal pellet bell rattles that signified her family heirlooms, was just the slightest bit of a mood killer. The barking of dogs and the scratching of nails on glass only compounded the confusion and anger that rose up in her soul.
Raiders!
Aradia shouted as she leapt from the bed, feeling her face curl into a snarl. She wanted to be ferocious. Responding to her will, her form shed the beautiful softness of her usual modern identity. Instead, she took on the visage of herself from ages past, the moment death had scarred her soul over 1,000 years ago. Mayan makeup, bloody red, sliced down the sides of her face violently. She felt her naked form envelop itself in the clothing of her people, a gray wraparound dress against her body and a tattered huipil laid on top. The sheer red garment torn and floating in an unseen breeze. Her makwahuitl was in hand, the handle of the ancient wooden club smooth against her palm, the head lined with wicked sharp obsidian. A bouquet of arrowheads sprouted from her breast. The chanted obsidian clustered near her heart, the shafts broken off by her own frenzied movements as she had died. Now the blows that ended her life couldn't hurt her, the garish display simply part of her spirit form. She gripped her makwahuitl tightly, gliding directly through the bedroom wall with murderous intent, leaving Salix to scramble up after her. Their living room was a mess, the cabinet displaying her family heirlooms, precious artifacts to anyone else had fallen over, trapping someone beneath them. 4 dogs of various sizes were running around the room, howling and scratching at the furniture. One seemed intent on opening her cabinet of fossils, slavering at the large stegosaurus humerus on display. She ignored the mud as she stalked towards the downed figure, absolutely livid, shouting threats at the intruder in her long-dead native tongue. She was vaguely aware of Salix running in from the hallway, of his instinct to protect his gaming device from one of the mutts, but she put it from her mind as she focused on the person thrashing among her treasures, her memories of home and thus her grounding on this world in danger. She willed her ghostly form to become solid as she neared the cabinet, grabbing it with the hands not already occupied by her club and yanking the display off the figure, pulling it upright so she could see the culprit. She leveled the obsidian at the thief's head, but the threat was ineffectual. He was covered by a large brown cloak, unable to see her as she threatened his life.
"Reveal yourself, coward! Who are you to enter this place?"
she shouted at him, instinctively speaking in Yucatan Maya, forgetting how unlikely it was that a Texan looter would speak it. Somewhere behind her, she felt 4 distinct pops of displaced air as Salix dealt with the dogs, presumably sending them elsewhere with his magic. The figure at her feet attempted to respond, but the voice was muffled. Finally, they managed to pull the cloak off, revealing the frightened face of a fairy, his antennae springing forth from his forehead, bracketing a mohawk as shockingly orange as the spots on his massive butterfly wings that were now freeing themselves of the obscuring garment.
The face was familiar, she realized, but her fury was too overwhelming for her to uncover the memories. The fairy looked up at her and opened his mouth in shock. Aradia? His glittering black compound eyes were wide and terrified. His head went back and forth from her death wounds to her weapon. He glanced around the room, looking even more confused by the lights, the TV playing Friends reruns on mute, and the cold air conditioning blowing down on his antenna. Where am I? Aradia froze in shock. She knew this young man, though he had been more of a boy at the time, a soft-bodied preteen, not a trim-figured adult. She realized her form was terrifying her old friend. He seemed to be shaking, wings a hum of movement, like he expected to be attacked. She disapparated the makeup and makwahuitl, the club fading out of existence alongside the arrowheads in her bosom, though retaining the ghostly clothes of her homeland. Recovering from her own state of shock, she spoke.
Savvy? Principal?
Said Aradia. The ancient form and the nickname felt comfortable in her mouth. Her memories, the past, her death long unsatisfied, began tugging at her gently. She frowned, forcing herself to shift into modern English to remember the when of the moment, grounding herself. Her form re-solidified. Ahem. Butterfly boy? We're in Texas. Houston. She could tell by the blank look on his face that these names meant nothing to him. The United States. Some recognition there, but not much. Okay, not much farther from where I was, Taffy said morosely. He looked up at her. You're dead, aren't you? A ghost? Aradia didn't detect any surprise in his voice. I am, both. You're all grown up now. Surely you know you last saw me centuries ago. The young man was a member of the Red Admirals, a fey clan semi-local to her area. They were of nomadic persuasion, spending part of their lives among the Mayan and the mortal realm, then returning to Faerie after celebrating Khatun. She had not thought of the boy in a long time. She hadn't known much about Faerie in life, so it was startling to realize the butterfly-winged child she once knew was still alive, that he still remembered her. I'm really sorry, Ray. I meant to come back to visit sooner, once I grew up. But we must have traveled too far from the places where time runs similar to yours. I'm sorry. Taffy looked forlorn to the floor, his wings drooping. I haven't been around cities for a while. When I popped my head in those places, everything started smelling bad a while ago, like poison burning the air. That and the, natural areas I used to travel through, they've been disappearing? I don't know what to call it. And then... He trailed off, staring into the middle distance. He kept staring, mouth slightly ajar. The shaking, which had subsided as he spoke, came back in full force. One moment, two, three, four. At the fifth, Aradia grew worried. She furrowed her brow. She reached a hand down to help him stand up, sticking it in his vision. Taffy blinked rapidly, focusing on the hand. His attention seemed to reassert itself in the present, his body forced to stillness. Oh, thanks, he said. He didn't seem at all like he knew, he just zoned out for a minute in the middle of his sentence. He took her hand with a look of sadness, tinged wonder, seemingly fascinated by the translucent quality to her form as she pulled him to his feet. He spoke again, voice soft. You don't look different at all from when I saw you last. You must have died soon after my people went home. I'm so sorry. I'm glad you're still around, but it's kind of spooky seeing you as a ghost. Aradia felt Solix come up behind her, and she let go of Tavi's hand as she smiled brightly and gestured at her beloved. Don't worry about it, Taffy. I hardly think about my death anymore. I've had such an exciting afterlife, seen so much and met so many people. My kin may be long gone, but I'm not alone. My demon has made sure of that. Tavi's massive, glittering eyes shifted to examine Solix, who jerked his chin up at Taffy in acknowledgement, giving the Fae the nod.
Demons were no secret to fairy kind, nor was their culture. The two were cousins in a way. Aradia counted on Tavi knowing exactly what she meant when she said, "My."
So, man, you nearly got my PS3 pissed on. What are you doing opening fey portals in our living room, letting dogs in the house?
Solix asked in a deceptively neutral tone. The very question Aradia wanted answered. She nodded in agreement, gesturing for Tavi to respond. He flushed, his coppery face like her own in shade, though much more vibrant. He opened his mouth hesitantly, revealing the fey's strangeness beneath his humanoid lips, an alternating row of black molars and long, wicked sharp needle teeth.
I didn't mean to bring the dogs here. I actually came to find Ray, kind of to get out of the Feylands. The Lord of Hounds brought, well, I think it was every single dog in the Mortal Lands to my home, and they,
his wings fluttered and he shifted uneasily.
Kinda overwhelmed me. There were definitely hundreds that thought I was a snack, and I was being hunted. But then only those four fell through the portal I opened.
He looked around, clearly wary of being ambushed by the beasts again.
I remembered Ray was good with getting domestic beasts to obey her. I was thinking about how she would deal with the situation when I opened the portal. I wasn't necessarily expecting to actually find her.
The Fae looked down, seemingly avoiding their gaze. His vision settled on the mess at his feet and crouched down, beginning to pick up various carvings, musical instruments, and other remnants of Aradia's first life. He carefully cradled the objects with his bulbous fingers, the artifacts looking awkward in his four-fingered hands.
Here, give me those. I'll put them back in the case, don't worry. I assume you didn't mean to crash into my heirlooms. You just never outgrew your clumsy flying,
Aradia teased gently, trying to alleviate the tension. Tavi smiled sheepishly and began handing her the objects. She began delicately placing them back in their cabinet, setting the damaged artifacts on the bottom shelf so she could restore them later. Solix started helping, picking the items up as well and carefully inspecting them for damage. The pellet bell rattle was cracked, pellets spilling out, and the demon spent a few moments carefully tracking down the small metal balls. Aradia was focused on the most delicate artifact of the whole display, picking up off the floor and gently brushing her hand against the cheekbone of her own skull. She loved her afterlife, really, but that didn't mean she would just leave her earthly body behind for some other archaeologist to find. She figured that as the only Mayan archaeologist born during the classical period, she deserved first dibs on her own ancient bones. Thankfully, the approximately 1,200-year-old skull was in good condition, and other than the replica maze being knocked loose from the jaw, it seemed no worse for wear despite the tumble. She slowly rotated it in her hands, examining the elongated parietal and occipital region, knowing her modified skull was weakened by the binding of her infancy. Satisfied with the structural integrity, she counted the jade inlays in her teeth, confirming that the trio of precious stones in each top front tooth was safe. Relieved by her findings, she gently placed the skull in its place of honor, then turned to the men.
"Well, if the Feylands are overrun with dogs, then we should let you stay with us, don't you think?"
She gave him a wide smile, wider than a flesh form could give.
"The mortal realm might be more interesting for you right now anyway, Tavi. The apocalypse just happened, and humans know about the supernatural again."
Tavi looked confused for a moment.
I didn't realize humans forgot about the supernatural, to be honest."
Tavi had adjusted to modern English with magical ease, but his knowledge was so outdated that it made Aradia giggle. He was like a piece of homemade reel.
"But clearly I've missed a lot. I've missed you, that's for sure. If you'd be fine with that, I'd love to stay for a bit."
Solix cleared his throat and spoke next.
"I suppose Tavi can stay, but we're going to have to give him a crash course on human history. The guy's more outdated than you are, A.A.
Tavi flushed again, scratching the back of his head awkwardly.
"I'd appreciate it, really. Also, you can call me Tavros, now that I've made it to adulthood. The pet name sounds a little silly, especially coming from a guy the same age as me."
Tavros grinned at Solix, fluttering his wings to show off his adult wingspan.
That little flirt. He really was all grown up. Aradia glanced at her friend, and a very Kanaya-esque thought came to mind. We're going to have to get you some more modern clothes, Tavros. She examined his present garb, a worn pair of sandals, thin, poofy shorts, the lack of shirt, the cloak that wouldn't hold up to a light rain. It's practically a swamp here. You need a shirt, and we'll definitely want some boots. Tavros shook his head at this, gesturing at his wings. But Salix cut him off before he could protest. Don't worry, dude. We know a tailor who specializes in clothes for alternatives. She and her daughter are good friends of ours. If we're taking you in, they'll help get you adjusted. He whipped out an iPhone 5 and started typing rapidly with one hand. Now, if you'll both excuse me, I have four dogs waiting patiently in the backyard for me to uphold my end of their deals. He said deals disdainfully. And Aradia was about to ask him what he offered them, but he answered that for her. Do we have anything I can give them as a treat? Aradia paused for a moment to ponder the nebulous state of their kitchen. She sometimes cooked meals from home for the sake of memories, but neither she nor Salix actually needed to eat. She shrugged. There might be leftover bacon in the fridge, she said this hesitantly, but it seemed to be enough for Salix, who shuffled from the room, returning to his regular slouch now that there were no more threats. She turned back to Tavros, hugging him fiercely. I've missed you too, by the way. How wonderful of you to be here, even if the circumstances are a tad absurd. He hugged her back, his antenna brushing against her floating hair as they stood together. Dogs guide souls to Shibalba, right? So I guess instead of taking you to the underworld, the Lord of Hounds had his dogs guide me to you. It must be fate or something, reuniting us. Aradia felt a soft warmth bloom in her soul. She couldn't help but send a prayer of thanks to the Lord of Hounds and privately swore to take care of his emissaries if they chose to stick around. It was the least she could do. Lost Girl. A dirty, disoriented girl with a throbbing limp wandered through Houston, inwardly cursing the cover of darkness. She was grateful for the shadows, slipping away from prying eyes who might notice the bloodstains in the light, but it didn't make searching for a particular river in Bayou City any easier. She'd crossed three streams already with no luck. She tried to remember what she was searching for exactly, but the memory was fuzzy. Too little rest and too little food had worn the girl down over the past 3 years, and everything was divided by the hot and bloody line of before and after. Before had been the carnage, the fear and the glory, the endless barrage of screams. After was the panic, the fruitless flight, the racing heart of predator turned prey. That bright light in between? That had been her moment, her cardinal sin, her escape from damnation as hell rained down around her. That had been her one perfect moment of insanity, the ice-cold clarity of thinking, she'll never find me if I leave now. The girl had approached the city from the north, or so she thought, and was slowly making her way in the direction of a river. She had smelled the water, of course, but the past several discoveries had been all new ponds and streams, a result of the changed landscape. The river she was searching for was older than that, a real waterway, the kind deep enough to swim in with bridges. The bridges were important, she knew that much. With a shaky hand, she rubbed her left temple, massaging the burn scar hidden under her lank hair, hoping to stir up a memory. A fragment floated to the surface, a joke made at someone's expense, a snarky remark that describing trusses and girders was the opposite of romantic. A shouty reply over a mic that he was
trying to be descriptive, you eight-legged dipshit!
A sense of relief that he was distracted from his tirade for the moment. Right. Girders and trusses. She remembered those, remembered looking the words up in a stolen dictionary, trying to draw the shapes without understanding them. She couldn't ask for a photo, not without revealing that she agreed with him, that she wanted to escape. And just like that, the pieces slipped away, buried under the thoughts of a nearby couple that strolled by, arguing about inane bullshit and thinking their stupid, shallow thoughts unbearably loud, drowning the girl's attempt to string more than two ideas together.
The girl scowled, sniffed the air, and followed the smell of algae. More water was nearby, and she hoped it was the river. She didn't know why, but she needed to find the river, needed to find the river, needed to find the river, needed to find, needed to, needed. Darkness. And with a splash, the river found her. The girl sank like a stone, the weakness in her bones and her clothes, so heavy with grime, pulling her under. The icy foulness of river water in her mouth terrified her, and the girl flailed, desperate to find the surface. She felt herself being pulled sideways, the river's gentle flow stronger than her. She thought she had fed recently. Was it yesterday? The blood of a full-grown man should have been enough. For any healthy vampire, it should have given them a power high that could sustain them for a week. But, though she was in no state to realize it, her recent meal couldn't overcome her brutalized leg, twisted and discolored from misuse. The car wreck and grazed gunshot hadn't helped, and she found her left arm was stiff with pain, near useless against the water. Her old wounds and new wrapped their tendrils around her, whispering death like a lullaby. As she thrashed, she managed to poke her head up for a moment and felt someone's thoughts on the edge of her senses, a fuzziness she hoped wasn't actually her own impending death. As she was dragged under again, she blindly grabbed for the thoughts and pulled hard. Whoever it was had been asleep, but as she sank again, she heard a shout of surprise. This time, as she went under, she wasn't the only thing flailing. Her target had been jolted awake. And as her vision darkened on the edges, she felt a growing tide of frustration and shock as the awakened figure darted through the water towards her. She was exhausted, and felt her body going slack in the darkness. Cold crept through her veins, a numbing sensation that dulled her will to fight. Her head pounded in time with her pulse, dragging out the moment until each millisecond was a silvery pearl rising around her, lungs burning and mouth foul as each precious mote of air escaped. Down and down and down she sank, feeling the water pooling inside her, finding no strength left to expel it. Dimly she realized the figure had dived down behind her, and she felt stony arms slip under hers. Tucking her back up against a cold chest, tilting her face toward the faint glimmer of light that was the surface. With a few powerful kicks, the rescuer propelled them up, breaking the surface and revealing a rapidly approaching silhouette against the sky. A bridge. They quickly reached the embankment, the girl's mind hazy, barely cognizant of the rescuer performing CPR, of the great gouts of water pouring from her mouth and nose as he forced her to empty her lungs and finally breathe. The air never tasted so good, and the hands of the rescuer were steady as he helped her sit up. Her chest ached, her windpipe burned, and every injury in her body was screaming for her attention. She whimpered involuntarily, panicking at the sound of the rescuer clearing his throat. Pain and fear fought for dominance in her mind, conflicting urges to give in to exhaustion or flee the unknown entity.
Holy shit, what the fuck happened to you? You look like a mob boss tried to dump a body but forgot to finish killing it first. Jesus, fuck! Who did this to you? Your foot! Oh my God!
Her rescuer sounded like he was hit with a sudden bout of nausea.
Hey, can you hear me? Do you know where you are right now?
The girl's head was spinning, and the loud, shouty tones of her rescuer were percussive bursts inside her skull, each word a stone thrown at a brick wall, threatening to spark a memory. His last sentence had been a question, and she felt compelled to answer it. She shakily pointed her good hand at the bridge, her own voice raw. Her voice cracked, unable to carry the sentence. She swallowed hard and tried again.
Trusses and girders. Needed to find the bridge. Was looking for.
She felt more than saw the stiffening of the figure, the way his fingers twitched at her voice, tightening the grip upon her slightly. He spoke again, the shock in his voice evident, the familiarity dragging at her shattered thoughts as he practically bellowed,
"Friska?"
"Beck. You, Beck Harley, are an unusual god. You do not usually receive prayers, especially not from mankind. Hearing your title, Lord of Hounds, used in a prayer raises your hackles. Whoever the supplicant is seems to have found the wayward pups and promises to take care of them. Their prayers are not panic-tinged, do not smell of smoke and flames. This is a good sign, you think, that the hot rocks may be gone. You are eager to rejoin the mortal realm, but instinct keeps you here. You simply know that this place, so steeped in magic, is the best place for Jade to heal. The mark on her head is fading, becoming a faint scar. She even starts to stir a little when you stick your cold nose in her ear, but it is not enough yet to awaken her. This worries you, and you wonder if it is time to start entreating her. The mother of mystics, her illustrious candescence, the being known as Isis or Hecate to worshippers, Candy to her consorts, the Empress of Magic. She doesn't talk to you much anymore, but you hope she will listen, given the circumstances. You served her once in a time long past, and the night sky, one of her domains, still enchants those of the Howl. Even as you think of the goddess, you swear you catch her scent, whipping your head around and searching for the source, but finding only your pup, stirring further. Time moves strangely in this summer land, and the moon, full and bright, rises as though pulled on a string. This is surely a good sign. You rise to your paws and bay. Your call is heeded by your people, and soon a choir across all the lands of Faerie rises to the stars. Few understand your magic, the power that runs through all dog kind, the power of bonds in their purest form, when the fragile rising man saw across its fire a predator, and the wolf a strange being, a strange threat. The genesis of two kinds was formed in kinship. You love your people, the world pack, each beautifully and terribly formed by mankind, each an expression of the needs and desires of your companion species. Jade needs you exactly the way you are, large and warm and strong, able to carry her and keep her safe. You used to let her ride on your back when she was small, and she would pull your fur and squeal. You wish she would pull your fur, but she lays still. So you call for the goddess, you stare at the moon, and you pour all your love for Jade and the pack into your song, hoping the goddess will understand. She knows the pain, the struggle, of loving the mortal, grasping at smoke.
For the full text of this and other stories by the same authors, visit the AO3 pages of Madam Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Constant Conquest by Michael Guy Bowman. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information on my website, which is located at sangabrielvo.com. And there you can learn about other stories that I've read, my Discord server, and ways to support what I do. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.